All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show, and that was Decisions from Outer National. That's the new sort of opener for the Michael Slate Show, so listen for that from now on, and then you'll know you got the show, you got the station, you got all of that, all right? We have a really, really exciting show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a piece drawn from a conversation that some people had with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It was a question and answer session after a speech he gave. The speech was about the Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. And Avakian answers the question, how is it possible to maintain a movement of that scale for a long period of time? All right. And before that, we'll be listening to an interview with Sam Menifee Leiby. And Sam, if people remember, he's the actual spokesperson for the D.C., the Dead City Legal Posse. And he's going to be talking with us about the more than 200 people who were arrested when Trump's inauguration was going down and basically are facing 60 years in jail right now. So we'll be talking with Sam about what's happening with that. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be talking with playwright Tanya Wisbar and actor Laura Liguori. The play itself is called The Red Dress, and it's really an incredibly important play, so check this out. I recently saw a play that I've been thinking about and talking about ever since, and it was one of the most powerful plays I've seen so far this year. It was about something that I think everybody should be thinking about, and as we'll talk about towards the end of this interview, that I think you really got to get it spread out around the country, okay?
Because thank you. It's that important. I would love to.
It's that important. And joining me now to talk about this is the playwright of that play, and her name is Tanya Wisbar. And one of the, actually the lead actor, I think, in the play. And her name is Laura Liguori. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
It's really
thank
a pleasure
you.
To have you. I'm going to jump right into this because there's so much to talk about, all right? And maybe what we'll do is we'll start with you, Tanya. Describe the play.
The Red Dress is about... It actually started with a question which I had very, very young because I grew up in Germany. I was born in Germany. And because I didn't know very much about my family because my mother, who was a single parent at that time, really never talked about the past and never talked about that she'd been married to a very prominent German film director, my father, Frank Wisbar. And he had used her connections when she was in Germany. She grew up in a prominent German film family. And through her, he became a very prominent and well-known German film director. And then the Nazis came to power, and he made films for the Nazis. And my mother was Jewish, and she was followed by the Gestapo all the time, pressuring her to divorce him and to leave. And she didn't do that. And actually, she stood up and fought the Nazis through radio and her own public image, which was a pretty strong one. The question that started the play was really, how does a civilized country, small incremental steps at a time, begin to accept the notion that other people are not equal, have no rights, and can ultimately be murdered, slaughtered by the millions? So that was the question. So I began to look at the one period that people don't really look at very seriously, and it is the most serious part of that century, is what set up World War II and the Holocaust and the Nazis. So the play is time frame between 1924, the end of World War I, and as Hitler comes to power. But the play stops at 1936 because I did not want this to be a Holocaust play, but I wanted it very much to focus on what causes the loss of democracy. And we're watching that, I hate to say it, in the United States. It's now a question. Step by step by step, are we losing our way altogether, or can we redeem ourselves and our reverence for democratic principles where we are all equal?
Mm-hmm. Now, one more question here, because actually, as I understand it, before you did this play, there was something that happened in relation to you discovering some material that your mother had written that actually sort of turned on like big lights in your head, right?
Yes, it was an absolute shock because my sister and I, she's 2 years older than I am, and we had pretty well grown up without much of a history. We didn't know that our mother was Jewish. We didn't have any religious background. We didn't have any network that we belonged to. And in 1999, I was living in Los Angeles, and I got a Sunday morning call. It was a very heavy male German voice at the other end saying, "Are you Tanya Wisbar?" And I said, "Yes," not too happily, because I have gotten some weird calls over the years. And he said, "I'm a German research professor, and I'm now at Harvard University Library basement, and I just found an 88-page manuscript your mother wrote in 1939. And this was in 1999, so it had been there 60 years, and my mother had passed away by then. And he said, "Would you like me to fly out and bring it to you?" And I said, "Yes." I wasn't absolutely sure what was next. So he did come, and he brought the manuscript. And it answered every question I had ever had about my parents, the erosion of their marriage due to the Nazification of the German film industry, which my father for a while worked making films for the Nazis. That was just a huge blow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. Is that why it took you so long to decide to make the play? Because you also said that people would bug you about it and you'd say, yeah, we'll talk about it later. And then 15 years later, you make the film.
Actually, the only person who ever bugged me was Jonathan Sanger, because he was my partner on Birthday Present 2050, which is a cheerless dystopian play instead of The Red Dress, which is a romantic story set against the rise of a tyranny. But I did read it finally, the manuscript, and it was fortunately in German, which I don't read that well. So it was a little bit of a buffer. I couldn't read it all. So I didn't have to take it all in. I could hide a little bit from what it was revealing. And I knew I would have to write about it at some point. So I did think about it. I just happened to think about it for 15 years. And then I realized I really had to write it. So... but I had to get ready psychologically. And the odd thing is that it did such emotional damage, even though I thought I'd thought about it enough. But I hadn't. There's no way to write about so tragic a period in history and your own family. You think you know your family? Well, if you write about them or start to, you will find out you don't know your family at all. It's just a shock. So instead of trying to adapt my mother, Eva Wisbar, and Frank Wisbar, I used them to derive the character of Alexandra Schiele and Franz Weitrek. And I was very lucky in the casting of Laura as Alexandra because I think she's just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And now we'll jump over to Laura because I have to agree, I was just mesmerized by your performance in the play. I thought it was really remarkable. And it's a hard one because when you go into the play and you're thinking, okay, now I'm watching this play about this Nazi that gets married to this woman. But you're sort of like, where do I go with this? And I thought you brought home something that was really important. You brought home a lot of the humanity in the play, which was from the very moment that you step onto the stage and the interaction you have with the various people in the, you know, at that point, and then all the way through, I thought you brought a lot of really necessary humanity into it. So
thank you. Cool.
Yeah, sure. Now, why did you do that? You can speak to what you want there.
It helps that my character is based on Tanya's mother, so it's a real person. So I derive a lot of my choices from the strength that I can feel from what her mother had to actually go through and up against and fight for. And people who are strong like that tend to have huge hearts, and strength really comes from love. So there's an aspect of my character that is incredibly loving and, you know, wants to have a family despite all of this around her, wants to create life, even though, you know, things are falling apart.
Yeah, it's important. But there's something here that really got me too, which is that you were very good at carrying out and you were very good in writing it, but that actually there's something there that thematically it was very important to play because the time seems so normal. We have the advantage of being out of that history, way back from it, and we can look back. But even doing that, you're sitting there and you're going, and you're, okay, I know the Nazis, I know what they meant in the world, they did all this other stuff. But when you present it the way it's presented, and it's actually so normal, like your character is very normal in the relationship with the man and what she's carrying out in her life, her career and everything else. It's really normal. And yet what you've done is that, says, as setting it the way you've done it, is everybody knows that the background is the Nazis are gearing up to do terrible things in the world. So I thought that was really important, the way that you played that too. It was very, very sort of systematically normal.
I think it was absolutely a challenge for me as the playwright to make it all look normal, because if you weren't the target of hatred for you, you could still live a perfectly normal life. And of course, the German people did continue to live a normal life until, in my mother's manuscript, there's a wonderful line. She said they built a fence through which no Jew could get at the end, but it turned out they were all imprisoned inside their own fence. Because all the passports were taken away from military age boys and men. When Hitler first came to power, he had a Hitler Youth movement, we all know that, and the German boys were allowed to go to Switzerland and to Austria and all that. But as the Nazis totally controlled what happened to the children, they were no longer allowed out except in uniform. Mm-hmm. So normalcy does not belong in any country where war is being created or hatred is given room to grow. And we're watching that here, and I think we are all quite terrified. But we're still going around normally and going to shop, right? And we're driving our cars and we're complaining about the traffic in Los Angeles. But it doesn't mean that we are safe. We're just not safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very important point. I was thinking about that very deeply after seeing the play and then reading some stuff around it, too. And one thing I'd ask you, Laura, you know, there's a point in the play where you're confronting your husband, and it's clear that there's been this crackdown. There's been things, you know, because it's the way, it's sort of the way that fascism develops. They do something hard, and then they back up a little bit, and they let people get used to it. Then they do something hard again. And something had just happened, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but the two of you were in a room, maybe the bedroom or something, and there's a point where he's telling you, you have to wear this dress, you have to do this, you have to do that. But he makes a comment about some grouping of people that was clearly Nazi rhetoric. And you had this look on your face, and I don't know whether you wrote it this way or you just did it this way, because it was brilliant no matter what way you did it. But you had this look that was like, just you stopped, and it was just sort of this quizzical but also very horrified look on your face about you, because it seemed like there was a realization of your husband was like going in a really wrong direction. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, there are many moments that I feel that actually happens in the play, and it happens more and more every performance. I notice that this underlying current is there sooner and sooner each performance for me, because I guess I'm just picking up on little things that even the actor J.B. Waterman is doing that it makes me very uncomfortable. The character uncomfortable on stage. But in one specific part, when he asked me to help him with his tie, and in the mirror reflection, I see that his bow tie has the swastikas on it. And that's just, it's horrible. It's, you know, my character fell in love with a man that she believed was her soulmate, and she watches him, you know, basically sell out his own core beliefs so that he can make films. And so, yeah, it's devastating, that part.
It's really interesting because a book on my father is coming out next month, which, I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of articles about Frank Wisbar. And as a parent, he was just absent and otherwise cold. That was my only knowledge of him, except when Fireside Theater started, there was only one hardware store in Alexandria, Virginia that had a TV set. So Tuesday nights, my sister and I could go stand there, and people would say, oh, it must be so nice that that's your father. And I thought, what a horrible, horrible life. I didn't think I had a horrible life, but I thought, how sad. But I didn't miss him. I just realized there was this considerable absence, and people would say, gee, he's famous. You're so lucky. And that wasn't true. So writing the play, and particularly the character of her husband, Franz, that was such a challenge because I really patterned it after my father. And he did make films before the Nazis in Germany, during the Nazis, and then after he had made it to the United States. Not as a refugee as we came, my mother and sister and I, we were refugees. He wasn't. He just came. And then it turned out the U.S. Senate wanted to hear his opinion about starting a glider program for the United States Air Force. But when I first wrote him, he was so horrible. I realized nobody in the audience would sit still for that. So I had to really work to find him redemption. And I do. But then I was no longer using him as my role model either. And that is really what allowed the play to finally get finished. If I hadn't had his real history as a glider pilot in the German First World War, I couldn't have found any way to end that play. So I was very grateful.
Yeah, definitely. One thing that got me too, though, is that, you know, just listening to what you're saying, it's also true, though, that when you're looking at him as you're going through and you're seeing things develop, it has a lot to do with what you're talking about, why you position that, the play between those years. Because there was that time where even with him, he had a chance to do differently, you know, and he didn't. You know, I mean, in a certain sense, he really does, and the actor personifies bored middle class boredom, you know, and I was using bored both ways. No, because no, I don't mean the actor in terms of him as a person, but the fact that it was just sort of like, I'm doing my job and I'm going to get, you know, this is what it requires. And I want you as my wife to come along and do what's required. And we're just going to have our life. And it was like that period, because that period between those are the early years of the 30s and the late years of the 30s was a period where, as we were saying, all this stuff was going on, but all the people were seeing stuff and, well, my neighbor's gone. I guess they moved, you know, or they would. I've read books more recently that tell about whole neighborhoods being driven out and being put on buses and trains and that people would then go and loot the apartments, the empty apartments. They would take the apartments or they'd go through it. It was like a big sale day because they could just go and pick out what the Jewish people who had been removed left behind. You know, and there's that normalcy that actually really comes through in the entire relationship until you make that snap look like, what? What the hell are you talking about? Which I think is really important, the way it's carried out like that, because you got the audience right there and everybody's starting to question, but then bam, and it doesn't come until you get that look that sort of says, okay, now some stuff is going to start going.
We've been really, I think, incredibly fortunate with the reviews we've gotten. I mean, they are far beyond anything I would have anticipated. On the other hand, I'm not a great anticipator, so, you know. But I think the normalcy is, I'll give you an anecdote of how creepy it gets, and not necessarily in the play, but it's part of the stuff around it. In 1999, after this manuscript was found, and I went to Germany, my husband was still alive at the time, and we went to the economic minister in Berlin to find out what had happened to my mother's 26 suitcases. And I knew that only because I think I had read it in something she had once written, not this document. But the economic minister, who was just a lovely young woman, she said, well, we found out what happened. And, you know, your mother, we built your mother, we being the Nazis, and she wasn't one. This is after the fall of the wall. We kept a small account for her in the bank, and we put all her stuff so those who were bombed out could have clothes. So we put all the Jewish suitcases on whatever street was still existing without a bunch of rubble, and people would go through the suitcases. I mean, the Nazis had taken everything of value, the carpets and the jewelry and all that was gone. But there were clothes. In our case, there were baby diapers and crayons and, you know, pathetic stuff. Mm-hmm. And she gave me the entire list of the contents of 26 suitcases. And she said, oh, there was like 200 marks for your mother built during that period. And it was like 5 pfennig at a time for a dress. And I was just so appalled. So I've always said, I wish I could have one spoon that belonged to my mother. Because I can read in 26 pages, I can read everything that was in those suitcases. Wow. So the Nazis were so tidy, they wanted to make sure in case the Jews ever showed up again, they would at least have 200 mark or pfennig or pennies in a bank account.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Wow.
All sorts of, the 3 years of research were really very worth it and probably ruined my mind forever.
Your mind seems pretty damn good to me, okay? So didn't ruin you, sort of. But here's the thing, we only have a couple more questions left, but you know, part of what you were just saying and your response of wow, it's sort of what got me too, because what you've done in this, where there's the future gets decided, the future for the people in the play gets decided on a real level. The wife is, you know, she knows what's going to happen to her. The husband knows what he's done and where he's going. And the audience is like really upset about a lot of the stuff. But there's a moment where an ideological question is posed, and I thought it was so great. And we won't say what is done, but it involves a very dramatic move by you, Laura.
Yeah.
I was going to say, by you, Laura. A very dramatic move that ideologically really sets things very, very importantly for people. It sets something for people to think about. And if you didn't leave the theater thinking about that moment and what difference it made, it would be really difficult. And it's the moment when you actually basically decide to lay bare what, you know, what's there. And it was sort of, it was too much, you know. And you could have written a character and it, you know, as one that would say, okay, I'll just like try to get by, I'll try to sneak by, I'll try to, you know, get myself and get the kids out of the country and do all this other stuff. But there had to be this moment where in the face of terrible inhumanity, that one person had to stand up and do one thing, even if it was in a small room where this Goebbels-like character and your husband were there, it was making a stand that was important for all of humanity and I think important for people to learn about today. So,
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yes. I think that it's really important that people use their voice. And I have always wondered, ever since I was a little girl, I've been really affected by the Holocaust. And I wondered how does this happen? How does it get to a point where you are killing children? You're murdering children. You're asking them to sing as you take them into a gas chamber. How does this even occur? And a few years ago, I worked for a not-so-nice woman, and I witnessed something happen. An individual, an elderly woman, crashed into her wall in Bel Air, and I watched my employer and other wealthy neighbors around looking at the crack, the hairline crack on the wall, talking about whose property it was on and insurance things, as this poor woman died. And it was then that I realized this is how it happens. The first thing is when you literally just worry about your own self, how everything just affects you to the point where it's all about money and greed and selfishness and your world is about protecting your little bubble. Meanwhile, like, the human beings around you that are suffering, you care not, because it's not you. And that's the beginning of how I think it happens.
Well, that's the whole point, really, of placing this play exactly between the end of one war and as another one is being planned. So people can keep asking the question, what is the slow slide? And it's not abrupt. It is very slow. It's giving up one right for everybody else at a time. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly, I mean, that's why it does not, I didn't let the play go into the Holocaust, because we know that story. We've seen that story. We think we understand it, but frankly, we'll never understand it. There is evil that you can't understand, and certainly the children. And I grew up with those images, and that's probably why I have a school mm-hmm. for developmentally disabled children, and why this play was so important ultimately.
Yeah, definitely. And that gets to the last question I was going to ask you, so we've already spoken to it, but it was exactly that point of, there's a point where you're confronted with this horror and you do have to do something. You do have to say or do something. And you remind people, and there was something I read that you wrote, you remind people that it doesn't happen in a day. It happens over a period of time, and an advancing willingness of people to turn their face away and to believe that it's not really happening or not even care that it's happening. And that's the big thing, because, and why I really liked you having it in that time period, because everyone knows historically what happened. But what if the person who, your character, Laura, what if the person that you had written, Tanya, imagine if that person, if there had been millions of those people doing what that person did, and things would have been different. And we're confronted with something very, very similar to this today. And
yes,
it's frightening and concerning, and we really got to do something about it. So mm-hmm.
it's what we do that remains the question.
Yeah.
What do we do?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. It's also, I really would like to see people just like call you up and say, yo, I really want to do this thing.
Oh, I would be so grateful. I would be happy.
How would they reach you?
Email would be better.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's www.hizzie@aol.com.
All right, great. That works. That works really good. And thank you both.
Thank you very much. Sure.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with playwright Tanya Wisbar and actor Laura Ligori. And we've been talking about Tanya's play, The Red Dress. And as she said earlier, if you're inclined to want to put this play on in your area, get in touch with her, all right? And she left the information on how to do that. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Sam Menefee-Leiby, who is from the D.C., that's Dead City Legal Posse, talking about what's happening to the more than 200 people that were busted during Trump's inauguration back on Inauguration Day. So stay tuned.
What good?
All right, now we're going to join a conversation I started back a little while ago with a person named Sam Menefee-Leiby. And Sam is from the Dead City Legal Posse, and it's one of the groups actually working really ferociously around the hundreds of people who had been arrested on conspiracy charges the day that Trump was inaugurated. And they were kettled by the D.C. police, rounded up, no rights, all rights ignored, thrown into jail, and all facing up to 70 years in jail. Or maybe, is it down to 60 now, Sam?
Yep, it's down to 60.
So why don't you give people a sense of, first off, review what happened real quick.
Yeah, sure. So on Inauguration Day, there was actually massive resistance to the Trump inauguration all across D.C. There were dozens of autonomous actions, blockading checkpoints, creating festivals of resistance, concerts, speaking series, marches. One of those events was an anti-fascist, anti-capitalist march that was quickly met with an incredibly high level of police brutality that hadn't been seen in D.C. since the 2002 Pershing Park incident, and that sort of changed D.C. law and standard operating procedure. The police continued to indiscriminately deploy pepper spray and stinger grenades and so-called less lethal munitions throughout the day, but especially against the anti-fascist, anti-capitalist protesters. About 230 of them were kettled and mass arrested, as Michael mentioned. They were held overnight, and folks figured that they would be charged with some sort of standard protest charge, and they wound up being charged with felony riot, which is a little-used statute in D.C. A couple months later, a grand jury was convened, and a superseding indictment was handed down that blanket-charged all of the people who were kettled with 8 felonies: incitement to riot, engaging in riot, conspiracy to riot, and 5 counts of property destruction charged under the conspiracy. Defendants have been organizing. Supporters have been, you know, forming support hubs across the country. There's been a lot of work done to sort of support people through these political charges. But a recent development was that Judge Lynn Leibovitz on November 1st finally handed down that there is no actually felony-level violation of engagement to riot or conspiracy to riot in the criminal code, as defense attorneys and many people have been pointing out all along, which knocks 2 of the felonies down to misdemeanors in the indictment. So everyone is still facing 6 felonies and 2 misdemeanors with a maximum sentence of 61 years in prison. On Monday, this past Monday, November 13th, there was another unexpected development. 7 defendants who were scheduled to go to trial on December 11th unexpectedly had their charges reduced from the 6 felonies and 2 misdemeanors to only 3 misdemeanors: engaging in riot, conspiracy — it's actually not clear what the conspiracy is for — and 1 count of property destruction at the misdemeanor level. Unfortunately, the next day, the folks who were scheduled to go to trial on November 15th found out that their prosecution was proceeding as planned. So the charge reduction only applied to 7 of the 194 remaining defendants, and the prosecution is pretending that it's totally reasonable to treat 7 randomly selected defendants out of a mass arrest and blanket charge differently than everyone else. So that's where we stand right now, is that on Wednesday, November 15th, the first 6 defendants go on trial for the 6 felony counts and 2 misdemeanors.
Now, have you had any indication of what kind of tactic the system is going to be bringing against the people?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a bunch of very sort of novel legal arguments being made by the prosecution. The prosecutor has stated in open court that she doesn't actually believe, and she is not alleging that most people actually engaged in any acts of property destruction or any violent activity whatsoever, but that the group itself was violent and criminal, and that mere presence is sufficient for indictment, and she is hoping conviction. So this is Assistant U.S. Attorney Jennifer Kirchhoff, who has been pushing this so hard. And she was actually appointed during the Obama administration. But they are really pushing hard on this conspiracy element. And then basically that, you know, showing up and wearing black to an anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march is sufficient to charge someone with conspiracy. It's a really very, very broad and very scary interpretation of the law.
Now, I guess one of the earliest hearings is around a journalist named Alexei Wood.
Yes.
And what's up with that case?
So there are 6 defendants in the first trial starting on November 15th. One of them is Alexei Wood, who is a photojournalist from Texas, and he live streamed the whole march. It's on Facebook. It's still up on Facebook. And the video is being used as evidence against everyone. And they are saying that him being there and live streaming it and reacting is tantamount to incitement, and that his live stream is not protected journalistic activity. It is not protected under the First Amendment. And they're really going hard after him, despite the fact that he is an established journalist.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've cautioned people that actually this is something that people really need to be aware of, right, in relation to it looks like that these people, that the prosecutors, the system itself is actually going to be trying to sort of pose people up against one another and have what one person may say or do be used against another person, because the fact that they're going to use, or that they're saying they're going to use all of his film against each and every person that's on trial is one. That's a major, major problem there.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, that's the sort of least of it. They confiscated everyone's cell phones who were in the kettle. There was over 100 phones. They've gone after folks, you know, online social media accounts. They've subpoenaed people's iCloud accounts. And they've gone after the Facebook accounts of organizers of, you know, the sort of broad resistance on Inauguration Day. They subpoenaed the entirety of the archives of the website for disruptj20.org, which contained over 1.3 million IP addresses. They're really casting this huge dragnet and pulling in all sorts of information. And they're alleging that text messages that contain just planning protests are tantamount to conspiracy to riot, and that one person's text is enough to sort of charge everyone with conspiracy. So it really is, they are using people's both public and private comments across a number of media against everyone, seemingly indiscriminately. The judge has reined a little bit of that in, but has allowed far too much to sort of be included in the case.
You know, I'm going back to this thing because it just seems like there's so much danger there in terms of being able to use what one defendant says or what one defendant has to be able to use that against other defendants to build a case that would end up sending both groups, both defendants, into jail, basically.
Right. You know, I mean, people often joke about, you know, guilt by association, right? And this is literally guilt by association. That is literally their theory that they are pursuing and that they are actively assuming will allow them to put people in federal prison for years.
Now, where do things stand in terms of how fast do they see this rolling out?
So defendants have been grouped together in groups of 6 to 9, many of them sort of arbitrary groupings, and are going to trial between November 15th and October 2018 is when the final scheduled trial is. So, you know, there are currently 194 defendants who are still heading to trial, which, you know, is more than 90% of those who were indicted, which is almost an exact flip of the normal ratio of folks who are indicted. Normally, more than 90% take pleas. And here we have, you know, more than 90% refusing pleas. It's a huge, I think, burden on the D.C. court system, and they're going to have to play it out over the course of more than a year. And we're, you know, starting the first case, you know, isn't going to trial until 10 months after the event itself.
Now, did I read that one person had already gone to jail?
Yeah, one person took a plea agreement for felony riot and assault and did serve time at Coleman Lowe in Florida. He's actually out now, and he's, you know, he's on parole. And he's in good spirits and is actually doing a lot of amazing community support work. He is redoubled in his commitment to community autonomy and social justice, and he's doing quite well.
Now, in addition to Alexei Wood, there was another journalist who's also facing charges?
There is, yeah, Aaron Cantu. He and I have a lot of friends in common. He's an editor at New Inquiry. He's contributed to The Intercept, to, you know, a number of excellent publications, and he's also facing the same charges as everyone else.
Now, do you see something in relation to how these things are going to roll out? Now that they've started, does it seem like they're going to roll out very fast, or is it like sort of a slogging pace?
I think that's what we're trying to discern. One of the hallmarks of the, you know, so-called criminal justice system in the United States is the outrageous scope of prosecutorial discretion. And so it really is going to depend a lot on sort of how the prosecutor decides to roll this out. And we saw on Monday that she can arbitrarily reduce charges. And to be clear, the 7 people who had charges reduced are still facing 3 misdemeanors that they should not be facing. All of the charges should have been dropped. But she was able to just make that decision on the fly. We could see things like that happen in the next couple of months, or we could see every single thing go to trial.
One last question. What would you say to people in terms of what's needed from them? What can people do and what's needed?
So I think that there are a couple of things that are needed. I mean, folks need to really sort of pay attention to this. There was a lot of hand-wringing last year and this year about Trump is a unique threat to the Constitution. And here in the first day, the first hour of the Trump administration, we had some very concrete threats to First Amendment rights and to you know, the rights to political expression and freedom of association. And people, you know, if folks want to be complaining about the Trump administration and the threats of the Constitution, they should be paying attention to the J-20 case. You know, what's needed is sort of increased solidarity. I mean, I think one of the reasons the prosecutor was forced to reduce those charges is because that she didn't just have the logistical capacity to try everyone this early. So I think that by supporting everyone who is going to trial, it allows, you know, folks to sort of stand in solidarity with each other and make the prosecutor's job much harder. There are, you know, ways that you can support. Go to defendj20resistance.org for more information and to, you know, sign up as a supporter. If you are in the Washington, D.C. area or can come to Washington, D.C., there are a number of things you can do here. There's also a fundraiser at fundraiser.com/J20Resistance. We have a goal of $250,000 in the next couple of months, and we've already raised more than $20,000. And, you know, that's going to be really important, and that's on top of the money that we were raising already. But it's going to take a lot to support 200 people as they sort of go through this onerous process.
Mm-hmm. And extremely important that people do step forward. Sam, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate
sure.
you coming back
All right.
on.
Take care, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Sam Menefee-Leiby, and we've been talking about the cases currently coming up in the D.C. court system of the more than 200 people who were arrested during the January 20th inauguration of Trump. Their trials are starting right now, and people's attention needs to be paid to what's going on there and stand in support of these people. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. Stay tuned. On November 4th, Refuse Fascism began a new phase of the struggle that will not stop until the Trump-Pence regime is forced to go and the nightmare ended. Their next step is national protest November 18th. As they announced, November 18th, hit the streets and multiply the size of the November 4th march. More cities, more people, more organizations all saying together, the nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go. All week long, into November 18th, there will be different protests, rallies, and ways to organize. Most important, what each of us must do is reach out and spread the word. Flyering, marching, speaking to groups. This is new and out of the ordinary for most of you. But there's nothing ordinary about this regime. Don't ever forget that, all right? It's time for ordinary people to do the extraordinary. On November 18th, there must be thousands more people getting to a situation where every time some new outrage of the Trump regime comes up, which is every day, people think of the They Must Go movement. And they think, I really do need to be a part of that. That's from the keynote speech at the November 4th rally, and you can find that at refusefascism.org. So now here's Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, answering the question, how is it possible to maintain a movement of that scale for a long period of time? Give it a listen and then go to refusefascism.org and find out what's happening in your area.
And this is a simple, it's not a simple question, but it's a short question. How is it possible?
That's not necessarily the same thing.
That's right. So how is it possible to maintain a movement of that scale for a long period of time?
Well, all kinds of things are possible if people understand the necessity for them. You know, you see, for example, in response to disasters of various kinds, all kinds of people swing into motion and donate all kinds of resources and things because they're so motivated to do so. When people don't the reason I spent a long time in my remarks talking about why this is necessary, what the actual situation we're dealing with and what the and you know what the implications of it are, is because the key to people acting is not being tricked into something. It's not having a clever way to get them to do something. You may get people to do things, but that's not going to be sustained and it's not going to go in a good direction. In order for people to act in the kind of way that's necessary and is being called for here, they have to understand why it's necessary. Because you are calling on people to, you know, to step outside of their comfort zone, to use that phrase. You are calling on people to make sacrifices, to break with their normal routine, to break with the way they would like to hope things could be resolved, many people at least. You know, most people would hope that it wouldn't require extraordinary efforts on their part to actually, you know, move this situation in a positive direction and avert a disastrous outcome. You know, people, you know, once again, we go back to Harriet Tubman and the slaves. There's a tendency among people to stay with the horror they know rather than to risk the one they don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's something we have to struggle against. You know, and you know, that's why people have to understand what are the stakes here. It's not that we're, you know, making this up or exaggerating again in order to trick people into doing something. Study yourself. Look into the reality of this. Look into what we're saying. Look into what I was talking about today. Is it true or not true? If it's true, what are the implications? What do people need to do? It's on that basis that people will act. And, you know, there have been plenty of examples of that. There are examples, you know, in the contemporary world where people did succeed in ousting, a government, you know, or forcing a government, a head of government to resign, sometimes with good outcomes, sometimes with not. But there have been examples in places, for example, like South Korea. There have been, you know, I felt a tremendous surge of pride when William Westmoreland, I don't know if any of you are familiar with him, but he was, for a number of years, the commander of the American forces in Vietnam. And he was replaced, and he came back and ran this line out that a lot of reactionary fools run out. But it did kind of give you a sense of pride when he said, "We never lost the war in Vietnam. We lost it in Berkeley." And I felt like, not just out of narrow considerations, because I came from Berkeley, but, you know, understanding that what he meant metaphorically, we lost it because people in this country stood up against it and continued to fight against it until, you know, that merged with the resistance that the Vietnamese people were putting up and refusing to be subdued. And we were forced to finally give it up. And so, you know, that was a more protracted process than we can afford right now. We can't afford 8-10 years of this. It has to be much more telescoped. It has to be much more immediate. But the same principle applies. People became convinced that war was just so horrific. I mean, they killed 3 million people in Vietnam, the U.S., many of them civilians, many of them little children. The My Lai massacre that many of you may know about, but everybody should know about, where they went into a village and just wiped out everybody, old people, children, everything, and then lied about it. And by the way, while I'm at it, one of their great heroes, Colin Powell, was an officer in the military at that time who was one of the main people responsible for covering up or trying to cover up what happened at My Lai. But as has been shown by people who studied this, that was not an exception. That was a pattern. That was what the U.S. military did, go into villages and just slaughter people. They dropped napalm, on little children as well as other people. Napalm, which they first used, by the way, in the Korean War, is basically jelly gasoline. And when it lands on people, it just essentially sets their flesh on fire. Some of you may have seen that picture of that little girl back from, the days of the Vietnam War, running down a road naked, having been subjected to a napalm attack. They used Agent Orange, which is a chemical weapon. They destroyed large parts of it. Vietnam was an agricultural country where people depended overwhelmingly on farming. They destroyed large parts of the land with these chemical weapons. When I was talking about, the generation that came of age in the 1960s and some of the great things they did, and then way far too many have become, to use that French word, récupéré, recouped, brought back within the under the wing of the system. A lot of those people did really heroic things. Some of them did stupid things because they became frustrated. And they tried ways of fighting back that weren't going to lead to anything positive. But overwhelmingly, people did really positive things in standing up against that. And it's because they became convinced. They refused to allow this to be done in their name. First of all, they recognized the horror it was, but also it was being done in their name. Just as these horrors are being committed today in our name. You hear these fascists, the American people, this and that. Well, the American people is not one big blob. There are a lot of different people, who have different viewpoints on things. And there's a large section of people that can't stand what's going on now. And we have to reach those people and get them to understand the necessity of what's going on. The necessity of dealing with what's going on, the reality of what's going on, and the necessity of dealing with it. That's the way things can become sustained, is when people really come to see the full dimensions of what's happening and the implications of what will happen if it's allowed to go on the course, it's going on. There's no shortcut to getting people to do what needs to be done. Yes, we should find a way for people to do things while they're learning. We should find a way for people to be involved while they have questions, and we should discuss their questions with them. We shouldn't treat people as if they're idiots because they have questions or they don't agree with something. We should honestly discuss these things. If someone can show that all this is not really that bad, and that the implications are not all really that terrible, well, fine. There's still plenty wrong in the world, but at least we don't have to do this. But let somebody show that. Let's see the argument. But the reality is, and there's plenty of evidence to show this reality, that it really is this horrible, that it really is going to go in a very disastrous direction. I mean, I don't know what the tactics are and the differences are, but what does it mean when someone like Trump, says these things about, that North Korea is going to face, terrible destruction like it's never been seen before? Or he gets up in the UN, of all places, and says he's going to, if they dare to do anything against us, we're going to utterly destroy them. What does it mean when he just, you know, says this weekend, there's only one course of action to deal with North Korea? You know, that's just one dimension. It's a very, you know, it is a terrible dimension. And even though there's a lot of jockeying and a lot of, you know, rhetoric being thrown around, things even on that basis can spin out of control. This is very dangerous. And that's just one dimension of the disaster that's in store. And people will move, people will act on the basis of understanding that and being one to see that. Not by being yelled at, you know. Some people deserve to be yelled at, okay? You know, but people who are, you know, these people who went to Charlottesville, you know, you're not going to reason with them, okay? You know, and certainly not in their masses. But, you know, there are a lot of people who are good-hearted, who want to see a better world, but are not convinced of things. You have to look. We can't sit down and talk to them for days while everything's going on. But you have to, you know, get them moving, and let's discuss things while we're moving. Let's have some, you know, debate here. Let's dig into the reality here. That's the way anything good will be built, is if we unite with people to act on the basis of what they understand at a given time, given that it's going in a positive direction, and continue to debate and struggle about what is the bigger picture into which all this fits. And, you know, that applies to driving out the Trump-Pence regime, and for us communists, it applies to the whole thing of making revolution. I was going to say, I got diverted myself, I have to get this in, talking about the Vietnam War. See, here's the problem again. One of the chants that people, you know, the most popular chant during the anti-war demonstrations at the time of Vietnam, when LBJ, the Democratic president, was the one, you know, presiding over this slaughter in Vietnam. One of the popular chants was, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today?" For very good reason. Now you see all these liberals like Rob Reiner, who, by the way, once knew better. He wasn't always, you know, where he's at now. He once understood a lot more and spoke in better terms. Makes a movie, you know, glorifying LBJ. So, you know, there's a lot of struggle that has to go on. But those people, you see, in those days, the motion was positive. I myself, you know, was hanging around on the Berkeley campus in those days. And I saw not just one, but a number of people who came out of families who were right-wing Republicans, voted for Barry Goldwater. Now, some of you may not know about Barry Goldwater, but you can go back and find out. was you know, extremely right-wing, you know, and to the point is sort of tottering on lunacy, who was a Republican candidate for president in 1964. I knew people, you know, students at Berkeley, whose families voted for Goldwater, and they were, you know, terrific radicals within 1 year. Because they were young, and they weren't, you know, they weren't tied into, you know, the idea that things could only be this way. And they weren't invested in the idea that you have to go along with the way things are, or the way your parents told you the world is the only way that it could possibly be. You know, back in those days, well, see, here I'm going to get myself into trouble. Back in those days, we had a slogan, "Don't trust anybody over 30. Because, you know, the country was being run by a bunch of old fuddy-duddies who were, you know, who were resisting everything good and waging the war in Vietnam and so on. And, well, now I'm really going far afield, but Jerry Rubin, who was one of the main organizers against the Vietnam War, was one of the people who helped popularize that slogan. Then when he turned 31, he said, "Well, we have this slogan, don't trust anybody over 35. So we have to be careful about sliding principles here. But my main point, to be, you know, get back to the main point is that people went through big changes in those times because big questions were being thrown up. And those who weren't deeply invested in, this is the best of all possible things, it couldn't possibly be any better, and anybody who says anything different ought to be forced to go to Russia or whatever, or told love it or leave it or whatever. The people who weren't invested in that were not only willing, but they felt compelled to look into these things because so many big questions were being thrown up. And people went through big changes very quickly, and that has to happen and can happen now, but it has to happen in a very telescope way because, as I said, the resistance to the Vietnam War was very important, but it built and was sustained over years and years. We don't have years and years now. So we've got to do this in a very intense and telescoped way. But the key point is people change because they're challenged, but also they're united with where they do have good instincts and good impulses, and they're challenged to look at the world as it actually is and to come to the conclusion about what needs to be done on that basis. When they see the necessity, even as they're being united with, when they see that this is what's really needed, what really needs to happen, that's when people can get involved and can sustain things.
All right, once again, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And the speech is, "The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible." And the question he was answering was, how is it possible to maintain a movement of that scale for such a long period of time? And you can find that on revcom.us. All right, once again, that's revcom.us. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today: Tanya Wisbar, Laura Ligari, Sam Minifee-Leiby, and I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a little bit more from Outer National and their song, Decisions. Talk to you again next week.